A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He wants us to walk through how a toaster actually works, the engineering of it, nichrome heating elements, the bimetallic strip thermostat, the electromagnet holding the carriage down, the spring-loaded pop-up, the timer circuit, and how browning is really a Maillard reaction triggered by infrared radiation. He wants a proper how it works explainer. And honestly, I've been staring at my toaster all morning. There's a lot going on in there.
There really is. And most people don't think about it even once. They drop bread in, push the lever down, and 2 minutes later, toast comes up like magic. But the toaster is one of those perfect devices where mechanical engineering, electrical engineering, and a little bit of chemistry all meet in a box that costs $15.
By the way, today's episode is powered by DeepSeek V4 Pro, writing our script for us.
Alright, so let's start with the heating element, because that's the part people picture when they picture a toaster, that glowing orange wire.
I always assumed it was just a wire that gets hot when electricity runs through it, which I suppose is technically true, but I'm guessing there's more to it.
The wire is made of nichrome. That's an alloy, typically about 80% nickel and 20% chromium. And the reason it became the standard is that nichrome has two properties that make it perfect for this. First, it has high electrical resistance. When current flows through it, that resistance converts electrical energy directly into heat. Second, it has extremely high heat tolerance. Nichrome can operate at temperatures up to about 1400 degrees Celsius without melting or oxidizing rapidly. In a toaster, the elements typically run between about 700 and 900 degrees Celsius.
That's wild. 700 degrees, sitting on your kitchen counter, a few inches from a plastic bag of bread.
That's where the design of the element itself matters. It's not just a straight wire. It's wound into a coil or stretched into a ribbon, and that shape increases the surface area so more infrared radiation can be emitted toward the bread. The wire itself glows orange-red at those temperatures, which is just blackbody radiation. Any object heated to that range emits visible light in the orange to red spectrum. But most of the energy coming off that wire isn't visible light. It's infrared.
Which is what actually toasts the bread.
And this is where Daniel's prompt gets specific. He mentioned the Maillard reaction. That's the chemistry that makes toast taste like toast. It's not the same as caramelization, which people often confuse it with. Caramelization is just sugar breaking down under heat. The Maillard reaction is a chemical reaction between amino acids and reducing sugars. It starts happening around 140 to 165 degrees Celsius. The infrared radiation from the nichrome elements heats the surface of the bread. The moisture evaporates. The surface temperature climbs past that threshold, and the amino acids and sugars in the dough start reacting. You get hundreds of different flavor compounds, pyrazines, furans, thiophenes, all the things that create that nutty, toasty, slightly sweet flavor.
That's why you can't toast bread by, say, blowing hot air on it with a hairdryer. You'd dry it out, but you wouldn't get browning. You need that radiant infrared heat.
The infrared penetrates just slightly into the surface and drives the reaction in a way that convection alone doesn't. Now all of this is happening inside a little box, and the box has to know when to stop. That's where the bimetallic strip thermostat comes in.
Okay, so walk me through that. The toaster lever, you push it down, it stays down, and then at some point, it pops up. What's actually holding it down, and what decides when to let go?
When you push the lever down, two things happen simultaneously. First, a pair of spring-loaded contacts close, which completes the circuit and sends current through the nichrome elements. Second, an electromagnet engages. The electromagnet is a simple coil of wire wrapped around an iron core. When current flows through the toaster circuit, it also flows through that coil, creating a magnetic field. That field holds a metal catch plate which is attached to the carriage mechanism. So the carriage, the thing holding your bread, is physically held in the down position by magnetism.
If you unplug the toaster while it's running, does the toast just fly up?
That's actually one of the classic ways to demonstrate that it's an electromagnet, not a mechanical latch. Unplug it, the magnetic field collapses instantly, and the spring launches the carriage upward. And by the way, that spring is under constant tension the entire time the toast is down. The electromagnet is fighting the spring.
That's a satisfying piece of engineering. So what breaks the magnetic hold? The bimetallic strip?
A bimetallic strip is exactly what it sounds like. Two different metals bonded together, usually steel and copper, or steel and brass. The two metals have different thermal expansion coefficients. When they heat up, one expands more than the other and the strip bends. In a toaster, the strip is positioned near the heating elements, or sometimes it has a small heating coil of its own. As the toaster runs, the strip heats up and gradually curves. Eventually, it curves far enough to physically push a switch that interrupts the current to the electromagnet. Magnet releases, spring fires, toast pops up.
That's the thermostat. It's not measuring the toast directly. It's measuring the ambient heat inside the toaster, which correlates with how long the elements have been running.
And that's why the dial on a toaster, the darkness setting, works the way it does. It's not a timer. What you're adjusting is the distance the bimetallic strip has to bend before it triggers the release. Turn the dial darker, and the strip has to curve further, which takes longer, which means more heat, more Maillard reaction, darker toast.
It's a distance-based adjustment, not a time-based one.
And that's the elegant part, because if it were a simple timer, the toaster would produce different results depending on whether the toaster was already warm from a previous cycle. The bimetallic strip is temperature compensating. If the toaster is already hot from making four slices, the strip starts from a warmer baseline, bends faster, and the second batch doesn't burn. That's clever.
That is clever. And there's also a separate safety mechanism in most toasters, right? A thermal fuse?
A thermal fuse is a one-shot safety device. If something goes wrong, say the electromagnet fails to release, or the lever gets jammed and the elements just keep running, the thermal fuse is designed to blow at a specific temperature, usually somewhere around 200 to 250 degrees Celsius on the fuse itself, which would correspond to a much higher element temperature. Once it blows, the circuit is permanently broken, the toaster is dead, and that's by design. Better a dead toaster than a kitchen fire.
That's happened to me. I had a toaster that just stopped working one day. No pop, no smoke, just dead. I'm now realizing the thermal fuse probably sacrificed itself for my safety, and I threw it away without any gratitude.
A moment of silence for that toaster.
We've got the nichrome elements, the infrared radiation, the Maillard reaction, the electromagnet, the bimetallic strip thermostat, the spring-loaded carriage, the thermal fuse. That's a lot of engineering in what I think most people would call the simplest appliance in their kitchen.
We haven't even talked about the casing, the outer shell, the thing you actually touch.
You know, I've never really thought about the casing. It's just, it's the toaster part of the toaster.
Think about it. The nichrome elements are running at 700 to 900 degrees Celsius, maybe 3 or 4 inches from the outer wall. And yet you can touch the outside of the toaster while it's running and not get burned.
I assume it's insulated somehow. There's probably a gap or some material between the elements and the shell.
Most toasters use a double wall construction. The inner chassis that holds the elements is typically made of mica sheets or sometimes aluminized steel, and the outer casing is separated by an air gap. Air is a surprisingly good thermal insulator when it's not moving. The outer casing itself, and here's where I think the material choice gets interesting, is either stamped chrome-plated steel or molded plastic, usually polypropylene or a heat-resistant thermoplastic.
Chrome versus plastic. I've owned both. The chrome ones feel more premium, but they also get warmer to the touch. Why is that?
Chrome-plated steel conducts heat. Even with the air gap, some heat radiates to the inner surface of the steel shell, and steel moves that heat efficiently across its surface. So the outside of a chrome toaster can get noticeably warm. Not burn you warm, but definitely warm. Plastic, on the other hand, is a thermal insulator. The same amount of heat reaching the inner surface doesn't make it to the outer surface nearly as efficiently.
Plastic is actually better, functionally, for the casing?
In terms of thermal performance, arguably yes. But chrome has advantages too. It's more durable. It doesn't discolor over time the way white plastic can yellow from heat exposure, and it's easier to clean. Grease and dust wipe off chrome much more easily than off textured plastic.
There's the aesthetic dimension. A chrome toaster on a kitchen counter looks intentional. It's a design object. A plastic toaster looks like an appliance.
And that's not trivial. The toaster lives on the counter. It's one of the few appliances that's permanently on display. The casing is doing a lot of work. Thermal, structural, aesthetic, and also safety. It has to be rigid enough to protect the internal wiring, it has to meet flammability standards, and it has to have ventilation slots positioned correctly so heat can escape without creating a fire hazard.
I've always wondered about the slot pattern. Some toasters have these neat rows of horizontal slots, others have a grid of little circles, some have almost no visible ventilation at all. Is that just a design choice, or is there actual engineering behind the slot layout?
There's absolutely engineering behind it. The slots are where hot air escapes. If you don't vent the cavity, the internal temperature climbs and the thermostat behavior changes, your toast gets inconsistent. But you also can't just cut giant holes, because then the internal temperature drops too much and the elements have to work harder. The slot pattern is a compromise between convective cooling and thermal retention. And there's a safety aspect too. The slots have to be small enough or shaped in a way that prevents a curious finger or a dropped fork from reaching the live elements inside.
I've definitely dropped a fork into a toaster slot before, not while it was plugged in, thankfully.
That's exactly why the casing is part of the safety system. The UL standards for toasters are surprisingly strict. The outer casing has to pass a flame test, an impact test, and an electrical insulation test. If the casing cracks or warps under normal use, that's a failure. And the material choices cascade from there. Chrome-plated steel passes impact tests easily but needs careful grounding design. Plastic passes electrical insulation easily but needs flame retardant additives to pass the flammability test.
What about the base? The bottom of the toaster? I'm looking at mine right now and it's got these little rubber feet, and the bottom itself is a separate piece, usually screwed on.
The base plate is often a different material from the rest of the casing. It might be thicker steel, or a different grade of plastic, because it's bearing the weight of the entire toaster plus the downward force when you push the lever. It also houses the crumb tray, which, by the way, is one of the most underappreciated features in kitchen design.
The crumb tray? I forget mine exists for months at a time, and then I pull it out and it's a horror show.
But the crumb tray is doing real work. It catches all the little bits of bread that fall off during toasting. And those bits are a fire hazard if they accumulate near the heating elements. A removable crumb tray means you can clean it without turning the toaster upside down and shaking it, which is both messy and risks damaging the elements.
The crumb tray itself is usually made of thin stamped metal, right? Sometimes with a little coating?
Usually tin-plated steel or sometimes aluminum. It slides into rails molded or stamped into the base of the casing. The engineering challenge there is that the crumb tray sits directly below elements running at 700 degrees, so it has to withstand radiant heat without warping. If it warps, it jams in the rails, and then you can't remove it. And then the crumbs build up, and then you have a fire risk. A warped crumb tray is a surprisingly serious failure mode.
I love that we're now talking about crumb tray failure modes. Daniel asked us to explain how a toaster works, and we've spent the last several minutes on the outer shell and the crumb tray.
That's the thing. The casing is not unimportant. It's the part you interact with. It's the part that keeps you safe. It's the part that determines whether the toaster lasts 5 years or 15. And honestly, I think the casing is where manufacturers make the most interesting trade-offs. Consider the difference between a $15 toaster and a $200 toaster. The heating elements are basically the same nichrome wire. The bimetallic strip mechanism is functionally identical. The electromagnet and spring are the same basic design that's been around since the 1920s. The core toasting technology is a solved problem. So what are you paying for when you buy an expensive toaster? The materials, the fit and finish, the quality of the chrome plating, the thickness of the steel, the precision of the stamped vents, the feel of the lever, which is also part of the casing assembly, by the way, the lever knob, the dial, the way the carriage slides in its tracks. All of that is the housing. The actual toasting mechanism is almost a commodity at this point.
You're saying that when I spent $80 on a toaster, I was basically buying a very nice box around $15 worth of heating wire and a magnet.
You are buying a box that won't warp, won't discolor, won't rattle, and won't look terrible on your counter after 6 months. That's not nothing.
It does feel a little absurd when you put it that way. The thing that actually makes the toast is the cheapest, most standardized part of the whole device.
By the way, the casing also affects how evenly the toast browns. A poorly designed casing with inadequate or uneven venting creates hot spots inside the cavity. The bread on one side of the slot gets more infrared exposure than the other. You get that stripy toast where one edge is burnt and the other is pale. That's often a casing design problem, not a heating element problem.
The casing is actually part of the thermal system. It's not just a shell.
It's the thermal environment, the casing, the vent pattern, the internal reflectors. Many toasters have shiny metal reflectors behind the elements to direct infrared radiation toward the bread. All of that works together. The reflectors themselves are often polished aluminum or chrome, plated steel, and they're positioned at specific angles to maximize even heating. If the casing is slightly warped or the reflectors are misaligned during assembly, the toaster will never toast evenly.
What about the color of the casing? Does a black toaster perform differently than a white one?
That's an interesting question. In theory, a darker exterior would radiate heat more efficiently. That's basic blackbody radiation physics. A matte black casing would shed heat to the room slightly faster than a shiny chrome one. In practice, the difference is probably negligible because the air gap between the inner chassis and the outer shell is doing most of the thermal isolation work. But I'd love to see someone run that experiment with thermal cameras.
Someone must have done it. The internet loves thermal camera content.
But the point stands, the casing is not just decorative, it's a functional, thermal, structural, and safety-critical component, and I feel like we've barely talked about the actual toasting mechanism.
We really haven't. We covered the nichrome elements and the Maillard reaction in about 3 minutes, and then dove straight into casing materials and chrome tray metallurgy.
Do we want to go back to the timer circuit? Daniel mentioned it in his prompt, and we haven't touched it at all.
Right. Some toasters have an electronic timer instead of, or in addition to, the bimetallic strip. How does that work?
Higher-end toasters and most toaster ovens use a digital timer circuit. Instead of relying on a mechanical bimetallic strip bending at a predictable rate, they use a simple microcontroller that counts time once the lever is pressed. The darkness dial becomes a potentiometer that tells the microcontroller how many seconds to count. When the timer expires, the microcontroller cuts power to a relay or a triac, which interrupts the circuit to the electromagnet, and the toast pops up.
That seems less elegant than the bimetallic strip, honestly. The bimetallic strip is self-compensating for temperature. A dumb timer would burn the second batch.
Unless the microcontroller also reads a thermistor, a temperature sensor, and adjusts the timing dynamically. And that's exactly what the nicer ones do. They combine a timer with temperature sensing to get more consistent results across multiple batches. But you're right, it's more complex, more parts, more things to fail. The bimetallic strip is a masterpiece of simplicity. Two pieces of metal, no electronics, no software, and it works for decades.
There's something beautiful about a purely mechanical solution to a control problem. No code to update, no chip to fry.
The bimetallic strip thermostat was invented in the 18th century. It's one of the oldest temperature sensing mechanisms still in wide use. It's in toasters, it's in thermostats, it's in circuit breakers, it's in car turn signal flashers, or at least it used to be before everything went electronic.
The modern toaster is this strange hybrid. The heating element is a 1905 invention. Nichrome was patented in 1905 by Albert Marsh. The bimetallic strip is 1700s technology. The electromagnet is 19th century. And then you've got a microcontroller and a digital timer if you spend enough money. It's layers of technology from completely different eras, all working together.
The casing is arguably the most modern part. Injection molded plastics, precision stamped steel, chrome plating processes, those are 20th and 21st century manufacturing techniques. The toaster is a museum of industrial history and a single appliance.
Which brings us back to the casing, doesn't it?
It always comes back to the casing. I'm starting to think the casing is the real story here.
You've completely lost the plot. Daniel asked about nichrome and Maillard reactions, and you're out here writing a love letter to the outer shell of a toaster.
Think about what happens when a toaster fails. What actually breaks? It's almost never the nichrome wire. Nichrome is incredibly durable. It can run for thousands of cycles without degrading. The electromagnet is a simple coil of wire. Those basically never fail. The spring might lose some tension after decades, but that's rare. What fails is the casing. The plastic cracks. The chrome pits and rusts. The lever mechanism, which is part of the housing assembly, gets sticky or breaks. The crumb tray warps and jams.
The toaster dies because its body fails, not its heart.
The heating technology will outlast the box it's in. And that's a weird inversion of how we usually think about appliances. Usually, the complex internal mechanism is what breaks. With toasters, the simple internal mechanism is nearly immortal, and the supposedly simple external housing is the weak point.
I'm now looking at my toaster with a completely different perspective. The chrome is slightly pitted near the top, right above the slots. I always assumed that was cosmetic. But you're saying that's where the heat exhaust is hitting the chrome and slowly degrading it over time.
That's thermal cycling damage. The chrome plating and the steel substrate expand and contract at slightly different rates as they heat and cool. Over hundreds of cycles, microcracks form in the plating, moisture gets in, and you get pitting and eventually rust. The toaster is slowly eating itself from the outside in.
That's bleak, Herman.
It's material science. Everything fails eventually. The question is just what fails first.
If I wanted to build a toaster that would truly last a lifetime, I'd focus on the casing. Maybe use thicker steel. More robust lever mechanism. Heat-resistant materials around the slot opening.
You'd basically build a 1950s toaster. Those things were tanks. Thick chrome-plated steel, heavy cast metal bases, simple robust mechanisms. Some of them are still in use 70 years later. The heating elements are the same nichrome wire we use today. The difference is entirely in the housing.
They probably cost the equivalent of $200 in today's money.
You paid for quality, and you got it. Modern toasters are built to a price point, and the casing is where manufacturers cut costs first, because it's the most expensive part. The nichrome and the magnet and the bimetallic strip cost pennies. The stamped steel housing, the chrome plating, the plastic molding, that's where the money goes.
We've essentially discovered that the toaster is a casing delivery vehicle with a heating element inside. The heating element is almost incidental.
I wouldn't go that far. The heating element is what makes it a toaster and not just a shiny box. But the casing is what makes it a good toaster versus a bad one.
I feel like we should acknowledge that we have completely failed to deliver the comprehensive engineering explainer Daniel asked for.
We covered the nichrome. We covered the Maillard reaction. We covered the bimetallic strip, the electromagnet, the spring mechanism, the thermal fuse, the timer circuit options. We hit all the points.
In about a third of the episode. The other two-thirds have been about the box.
The box matters.
The box matters, but Daniel specifically asked about infrared radiation and Browning chemistry, and we gave that maybe 4 minutes before you veered into chrome plating degradation patterns.
In my defense, the chrome plating degradation is genuinely interesting.
I'm not saying it's not. I'm saying we have a problem. We get obsessed with the wrong thing.
I prefer to think of it as following our intellectual curiosity wherever it leads.
Which is always the casing. We could be talking about rocket engines, and you'd find a way to spend 20 minutes on the paint they use on the nozzle.
Thermal protection systems are fascinating.
We need to wrap this up before we start analyzing the rubber feet on the bottom of the toaster.
Now that you mention it, the rubber feet are interesting. They're usually made of silicone or EPDM rubber, chosen for heat resistance and grip. And the height of the feet determines the airflow under the toaster, which affects cooling of the base plate, which affects...
The toaster is a brilliant piece of engineering. Nichrome wire, patented in 1905, runs at 700 to 900 degrees Celsius, emitting infrared radiation that triggers the Maillard reaction in bread at around 150 degrees Celsius. A bimetallic strip thermostat, made of two metals with different expansion rates, curves as it heats and eventually releases an electromagnet that's been holding a spring-loaded carriage in the down position. The toast pops up. A thermal fuse stands ready to sacrifice itself if something goes wrong. And all of this happens inside a carefully engineered casing that manages heat, provides structural integrity, and, if you're lucky, doesn't pit and rust after a few hundred cycles.
The crumb tray. Don't forget the crumb tray.
I won't. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The Greenland shark can live for over 400 years and doesn't reach sexual maturity until around age 150.
Right.
That gives a whole new meaning to taking your time.
One forward-looking thought before we go. The toaster has been basically the same device for 100 years. The materials have improved, the manufacturing has gotten cheaper, but the fundamental design is unchanged. I wonder if there's actually room for genuine innovation, or if the toaster is one of those rare devices that's already as good as it needs to be.
Someone's probably working on a toaster with a touchscreen and Wi-Fi connectivity right now, and it will be worse in every way that matters.
Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop for keeping this show running. This has been My Weird Prompts. Find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Maybe go appreciate your toaster's casing today.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.